All right, here we go.
Hello, and welcome to the JuntoCast, a podcast on early American history. I'm Ken Owen, an Associate Professor of History at the University of Illinois Springfield, and the Distinguished Visiting Fellow in History at the Kinder Institute on Constitutional Democracy at the University of Missouri. It's been a while since we've been in your podcast feed, and we know that some of you have noticed our absence. We're back, and we're hoping to get back to a regular schedule and appearing with the early American conversations that you know and love on a more regular basis. One of you even commented in the iTunes store that you wondered if it was any coincidence that it was October 2016 that was the appearance of our last episode. Yes, is the short answer. It was a coincidence. It was not the events of November 2016 that put paid to our scheduling, but rather a slew of life events, including marriages, babies, city moves, and writing books. We hope that things have now settled down enough that we can get back to a regular schedule, although in the current circumstances, who knows? So, I'm joined by Michael Hatton, Visiting Assistant Professor of History at Knox College, a contributing editor to the Junto, and author of Past and Prologue, Politics and Memory in the American Revolution, which will be published by Yale University Press in November of this year. Congratulations on the book, Michael, and glad to have you back here.
Thank you, Ken, and hello, everyone.
I'm also joined by Roy Rogers, who is social studies teacher and blended learning coordinator at Yes Philly Accelerated High School. It's great to have you back, Roy.
Howdy, Ken. Glad to be back.
For this episode, we're going to be keeping as topical as you can expect from a podcast that's been absent for 4 years and discussing the topic of impeachment and early America. Later in the episode, we'll be looking at the Anglo-American origins of impeachment. We'll be looking at the Constitutional Convention debates and the ratification debates insofar as they touched on the process of impeachment. And then we'll look at some of the earliest examples of federal impeachment under the new Constitution. But before we get into that, I thought it would probably be helpful to give a sentence or two just explaining what we're talking about when talking about impeachment. And we're particularly looking at the constitutional and political origins of the practice of impeachment in early America, and that is to say the removal of office holders from legislative, executive, or judicial office, and how that was discussed and debated in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. Now, Michael, I know you had more to talk about with the origins of impeachment.
So the first impeachments in the Anglo-American world, at least, effectively date back to the late 14th century. But it's not really until about the 17th century that it started to become, if not more common, than happened in something of a more common way. And a big part of that has to do with the sort of rediscovery of this process of a mechanism of impeachment by Parliament in the early 17th century, right? This is a time when Parliament itself is sort of coming into its own, asserting itself in ways that it hadn't done in the past. Of course, this would ultimately lead to civil war in England in the 1640s. But this this mechanism of impeachment became became a parliamentary mechanism, effectively, in the 17th century as a result of these struggles between Parliament and the Crown. And it was effectively meant to serve as, you know, Parliament's check on not the king, but the king's ministers, right? And it's at this time when we get the origins of the phrase high crimes and misdemeanors, which we'll talk about later. In the colonial period, in the North American colonies, the colonial assemblies adopted this practice of impeachment primarily as a way to try and restrain royal governors and proprietary governors, and especially their counselors, right? So we have a number of examples from the colonial period, especially the 18th century, of as the colonial assemblies start coming more into their own and asserting their prerogative, much like Parliament did in the 17th century, they too adopt this mechanism of impeachment as a way of asserting some kind of check on other branches of the colonial governments.
Yeah, I think the royal origins of impeachment is really important to understand for some of the debates that go on in the Constitutional Convention, because it's kind of natural that impeachment would emerge out of that context, right? Because in the specific British moment, right, it's in an area where the tie between who's in civil offices and elections doesn't exist like it does today in the UK or in the United States. And of course, you can't remove the king short of civil war. So what's the mechanism that is going to exist that's going to give Parliament, the people, an opportunity to remove royal ministers if the king proves less than willing to sack that minister? And impeachment kind of exists as this sort of middle ground between revolution and election. That awkward place in a Republican political sphere where, you know, representatives are supposed to be chosen by election to represent the interests of the people, you know, that's going to be debated a bunch in the Constitutional Convention, which we'll talk about in a few more minutes.
Yeah, and I think it also speaks to just how much this touches on one of the problems of power within any governmental system, that when we look at the British origins, I mean, discussing what to do with people using power improperly has been a feature of British politics throughout the 1500s and 1600s, and Parliament claiming a right to impeachment comes after various examples of royal excesses. Even then, the system had mechanisms like the Star Chamber that were meant to restrain power and then turned into something that actually supercharged the power of the most powerful. And that this was very messy, that it was difficult to find a totally watertight legal procedure that could outline the responsibilities of those in authority. And I think that's something that we also see when impeachment does come to the colonies, that in many cases, impeachment is often little more than a way of constraining some of the excesses. It doesn't necessarily guarantee removal of the officials, because that still requires the rubber stamping of the English crown. And the colonies aren't fully willing to push their power right the way to what could be a potential showdown with the crown in the 1600s. However, the stigma of having some official censure of your conduct through a House of Assembly and a council does go some way towards redressing the balance between governor and governed in many of those cases.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think part of what the colonial assembly's tactics would be, I mean, because they could not remove a royal governor, was to use this mechanism against the royal governor's council, right, and counselors. I think it's also important to point out that impeachment, it's not just a product of the of this distant Anglo-American past. It was also a product of the political ideology of the time, right, which saw power as dangerous, right? And it was dangerous not just because bad people might get power, but because even a virtuous person could be corrupted by power, right? Power was had a corrupting, corrosive influence even on you know, the most virtuous of people. And so for a lot of the Americans in the revolutionary era, this was exactly what they saw had happened to Parliament and the king and his ministers in the 1760s and 1770s. And that's what required independence in the first place. And so this we have a political ideology in the time that was keenly attuned to the need to constrain power, right, because of its corrosive and corrupting influence.
Yeah, I also think one of the things that's interesting to me looking into the colonial and English-British origins of impeachment is there's actually lots of points of continuity. For Americans sitting here in the 21st century, having in recent memory gone through two impeachment processes, you see that what's weird about impeachment is it's both quasi-political and quasi-legal, where it is a political process that is trying to also enact some kind of like legalistic norms. And that creates a lot of the kind of tension that we're going to explore when we get into the Federal Convention and the Federal Convention's sort of like lack of clarity about it and their own internal debates. And of course, how impeachment has played out as a political practice in the United States. And that goes all the way back to the initial origins. And this is one of the, like, it's just really interesting to me, the more I've looked into it, just how much continuity has existed with this sort of liminal nature of what impeachment is and the difficulties of it. It's not something that, you know, the Americans bastardized some successful British political practice. It is instead, it's always been this awkward quasi-political, quasi-legal mechanism.
And that's been something that's provided one of the challenges of pretty much any impeachment debate that you look over, that on the one hand, people will often in the defendant's side will say that this has to be a legal process and there have to be a very strict set of procedures that are followed and everything has to be very narrowly defined. And people on the accusatory side emphasize that this is political, but then they kind of recognize that impeachment itself isn't really a legal process in terms of anything other than removal from office, but at the same time, in putting supermajorities and all sorts of very explicit procedural hurdles in the way, they recognize that this is something beyond the realm of pure politics as well. So looking at the nuts and bolts, as well as the ideology and rhetoric, you really do see what a strange and puzzling procedure it can be.
Yeah, I think it's also important to sort of to point out that there's a distinction here to be made between legal and criminal, right? So it is a legal process, right? I mean, it involves investigations and juries and trials, but at the same time, that just because it's legal does not necessarily mean that it is also criminal, and that is a distinction that the framers in the convention faced and had to confront.
Well, that seems like a good time to move on to discussion of what were the framers thinking about impeachment when they discussed it in Philadelphia in 1787. So what do we want to talk about when it comes to the debates at the Constitutional Convention and what that reveals to us about how the particular federal American procedure of impeachment developed?
Yeah, so I think there are really three questions, I think, that the convention faced when it comes to impeachment. And just those very quickly, those three questions are: the first question is, should the executive be able to be impeached? if you grant that the executive should be impeached, the second question is, who does the impeaching, right? And then the third question is, for what can the executive or the president be impeached for, right? So those are really the three, I think, core questions here.
Yeah, and I think the first two, I think, show the tension of impeachment in a Republican system, right? So the question that is constantly being confronted as they're debating this is, are elections enough to act as a check on executive Or even initially, there's some debate, and we'll talk about it a little bit, about whether or not members of Congress, senators, or members of the House can be impeached. You know, it's played out that they can't, that the House and the Senate use their rules to exclude members to do that function. But, you know, initially it's thought that could be a possibility. And whether these civil officers' elections are enough, right? And there was legitimate debate in the, you know, over this. And I think that it comes to one of the central ideological tensions, right, of this Republican experiment, which is that we want to be saying we're placing this sovereign power from elections into the national government. But what happens if, you know, that sovereign power is misapplied in a way that the people can't understand at the time? Like, so if an election is done improperly, or if you know, a demagogue gets through all the various checks that, you know, the founders put in place, the Electoral College, you know, how to resolve that tension? Do you just wait it out, the 4 years or the 2 years or the 6 years, or does there need to be an immediate remedy? And I think that was, I think, the most puzzling theoretical debate that was going on in the convention over the impeachment issues.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, it's pretty early, relatively early in the convention that the process of impeachment. This is in the early in the debates about the executive that the issue of impeachment comes up, and when it's proposed, Governor Morris especially sort of argues against including an impeachment mechanism. And what he says, or what James Madison quotes him as saying, is that in case he should be reelected, that will be sufficient proof of his innocence, right? And that really goes to this tension that Roy is talking about between the tension that elections brings into a Republican system, right? There were some who agreed with Morris, but clearly not all.
And I think it's worth noting here about how unusual the terms of office in the federal constitution are at the mm-hmm. time, that a lot of the ratification debate focuses on 6 years being an inordinately long amount of time between elections for senators, 4 years, a troublingly long amount of time for the executive. And when we look at a lot of state practice, it's annual elections, and mm-hmm. that certainly much more frequent elections. And that certainly comes through on the part of those who seem to suggest that elections are enough of a safeguard. That it seems to come out of a political culture where there is much more familiarity with being able to turf people out of office. And I mean, that's something that is mentioned and asserted as a fundamental right in pretty much all of the significant state constitutions with declarations of rights, that there is a right to reduce public officers to a private station. And I do find that's something that, going back through the convention debates, really stood out to me, that there's a recognition that in setting up the government on a longer institutional footing for various and often good reasons, it did mean that this question of what to do with an improper official became much harder to work out.
Right. And I mean, this question of you know, term length was something that was one of the first questions, right, talked about during when the executive was raised at the convention. And, you know, one proposal was for 3 years, another proposal which had some support was 7 years, right?
Can we throw some shade at Alexander Hamilton here?
We can always do that.
Yes, I mean, some people wouldn't have been completely opposed to a president for life, would they?
That is true. That is true. But I think the point there is that you know, the impeachment, the settling the issue of impeachment, because Morris eventually. Acquiesced to an impeachment clause, you know, with such long terms being suggested, right? That made impeachment a more palatable and a more necessary mechanism to include. And in many ways, it's really only after the impeachment question gets settled in July of 87 that the majority finally agrees to have a single executive, right? Because up until then, there were still proposals for, you know, a three-person executive, right? Or more in terms of having a council as an executive. And it's only after impeachment is settled that many of the people who supported a multiple executive came around and agreed to this idea of a single executive.
Impeachment does some really useful institutional work, particularly if you view a lot of the framers as using the Constitution as an opportunity to insulate power from responsibility, with immediate responsibility to the people, with these longer term limits, with fewer national representatives, and eventually, you know, a single president. If this, you know, plan goes too far, if this national cool down zone that would be the federal government goes too far, impeachment is a good escape valve. If they're almost too good at their plan of cooling down some of these, you know, tricky national issues that that scholars like Woody Holton point to as driving a lot of the appeal to the Constitution to, you know, the wealthier segments of society, the impeachment is a really useful tool of like, oh, we went too far, we screwed up. We can remove this from office. So again, in many ways, it reinforces some of the other structural changes that the Constitution is making in a small C conservative direction.
Right. So I think that sort of takes us to the second question, right? Which is okay, we're going to have an executive, and the executive is going to be subject to impeachment. Who gets to do the impeaching? Why does that matter, Ken?
Well, I mean, it matters because if we look at 1776, the problem has been what happens when a Republican form of government is administered by people that are no longer governing in the interests of the public. That is pinned very much on the prerogative powers of the British executive, and that therefore the whole American system of government has been based on how do you constrain the executive. At the same time, that then revealed another problem about the use of power, which is that if you shift that power from the executive to the legislature can start to use it in ways in which it might not always be conducive to best government or to the matter of the public weal. And that has a particular importance with regards to impeachment, because it's looking at the separation of powers. So can you have the legislature or the judiciary sitting in judgment on the other branches without rendering them dependent on one of those branches? Right. And it also cuts to a point that I think is important within the state constitutional context that I mentioned earlier, which is that a lot of the delegates in Philadelphia do not like the way that legislatures have interfered in judicial functions. And they've done that definitely in Pennsylvania. They've done that in New Hampshire. And there is some uneasiness that if you allow too untrammeled a power for one branch to supervise the other, then that branch becomes all-encompassing and it begins to undercut some of the bolder claims that the Constitutional Convention makes about the necessity of separation of powers.
Yeah, particularly since the way we understand checks and balances today, like if you know you make the chart in a social studies class, impeachment and removal from office is usually viewed as one of the, you know, the extreme but necessary checks and balances for the legislative branch against the executive branch and the judicial branch. But the, you know, for the founders sitting in Philadelphia, sweating away in Philadelphia, they had the opposite logic, right? They didn't want the president to be something like a modern day prime minister, answerable mostly to the legislative branch. And there was this fear then, if that happened, they become a creature, as Ken noted, that they would not, that, that we wouldn't have the rigorous, energetic executive that a lot of the framers thought that, that that there should be. So, like, today we think of, you know, impeachment as a natural outcome of the drive towards checks and balances. But actually, for many people in Philadelphia that summer, it was the opposite, that actually that would be one check, one balance too far. And that's, like, one of the, like, that that counter to our natural logic is one of the more tricky things, I think, about this debate than that doesn't come natural.
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes so far as to be an imbalance. I mean, one of the things that gets mentioned regularly is, can you expect the executive to veto a legislature that could then seek to punish the executive for having the temerity to question them?
Right. And when we briefly talk about the Johnson impeachment later, you know, that's going to be a question that comes back up, right? Is that that is probably the closest impeachment has been used to do that, which is to sort of make the presidency more directly accountable to Congress. And so we'll get to that in a little bit.
So I think, like, I think that what we're seeing here is the idea that, I mean, that this debate over impeachment was central, right, to the process of constructing what the framers thought would be a properly balanced constitution. Right. Where certain delegates fell in terms of the impeachment debate, you know, though there were multiple positions, you know, the primary concern for all in terms of this discussion had to do with balance, right? Balance between the branches. I think one of the other ways that we see that, and one of the other ways that this discussion was tied to the broader discussion around the executive, is that one of the first proposals was to have impeachment done by the Senate, right? I mean, rather than you know, a lower house, which were not popular among the framers, thanks to the preceding decade, but it was to have the Senate to lodge the impeachment power in the Senate, But the problem with that was that at that point in the convention, it was still a likely possibility, or there was still a lot of support for the idea that the Senate would be who elected the president, right? And if you can't have a part of one of the branches be able to elect and remove, right, or elect and impeach the executive. So it's another way in which, you know, the impeachment question was central to the debate about the executive, their ideas about a balanced constitution, and those ideas, they sort of changed over the course of the convention.
Yes, although I think this does highlight one of the things that I always find interesting looking back at the debates at the Constitutional Convention, which is that for something that you can link to so many essential key parts of how a government operates, there's also a lack of specificity about the impeachment clauses and about how the procedure should actually play out. I mean, I think partially that's inherent in the question of impeachment, that you either have an idea of what someone has done wrong in the past and you want to stop them doing it again, or you can't really advocate for a new system, saying that it's likely to elect the sort of people that would commit the sorts of crimes for which you would require impeachment. But at the same time, I noticed this when I looked back at the debates over the Electoral College, when I've looked at debates where various different members of the convention threaten disunion, that there's kind of a recognition that you need to have some sort of impeachment in there. And when it's brought up, everyone says, okay, we need to be able to impeach, or at least they come round to that viewpoint. But they don't want to break up the union over the question of what impeachment should look like. And so in this case, they end up with quite a general provision. I mean, in the case of the Electoral College, they end up with a compromise that no one has liked, and they've rejected several times before they actually approve it. But it does tell you something, I think, again, about the context of 1787, that it's so different from the way that it has emerged in public memory, that there wasn't a clear idea of exactly what impeachment would look like, and it might have structured some of the debates over the executive branch, but it only went so far in getting people to think really substantively about what abuse of office would be.
Right. So that takes us to the third question, right, which is about enumeration and what actions, you know, should be impeachable for a president. So what can get a president impeached?
High crimes and misdemeanors.
And treason and bribery. What part of that is not clear to you, Michael?
What part of it is clear? Well, I think actually one of the reasons why it's not clear is one of these interesting quirks of personality, right, is the outsized influence of Gouverneur Morris on actually writing the clauses, where you have someone who is skeptical at best of impeachment is the person who is writing, you know, is at these key moments where they're trimming, adding, sometimes adding, but more frequently subtracting clauses from the impeachment language. You know, Morris is there, and in many ways, limiting it from broader interpretations, but by limiting it, also making it much less clear. So while the bribery, treason, high crimes and misdemeanors, compared to all the possible things you could list, there is a much smaller subset of what was proposed. It's a very vague subset of what was proposed.
Yeah, so I think to lay out what Roy is alluding to, Gouverneur Morris was effectively the draftsman of the Constitution and a member of the Committee of Style, and so he was largely responsible for the final language of the final draft of the Constitution, and he made a very significant change. The original clause was to read, impeachment by the House and conviction by the Senate for treason or bribery or other high crimes and misdemeanors against the United States. Right now, Morris ends up taking out that last phrase, against the United States. And there's a lot of debate about whether, what his intentions were in doing that. But the effect of it is that it ends up making what can possibly constitute an impeachable offense much broader, right? Because now it doesn't necessarily have to be a high crime or misdemeanor against the United States, which seems to sort of sort of sounds like light treason or treason light, right? But without that, the scope is broadened considerably. So what are the sort of things that they thought would warrant impeachment?
Buying an election is one of them. I mean, that's mentioned quite explicitly in debates. What if someone who has committed crimes to get the office is prevented from being prosecuted for the commission of those crimes. So irregularities in the election process are very clearly envisaged as part of that.
Yeah, I mean, when George Mason argued for impeachment, that was his first sort of example, right? What if the president should attain the office in some kind of corrupt manner? You have to have a way, right, to remove them from that. I think another one is the issue of, and this goes back to, I guess, elections in a sense, is this idea of foreign assistance, right? If the president is aided by foreign actors in securing the presidency, that is something that would warrant impeachment. And that was something that both Madison and Morris, you know, that's an issue that they raised during these debates.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that's noted by that language that Morris ends up cutting, right, against the United States. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you view these also in context of other clauses of the Constitution, you know, excluding foreign nationals from that, excluding titles of nobility, or even having titles of nobility from other countries, it's just part of a consistent fear that the new United States would be co-opted by some foreign power. And yeah. In many ways, I think that's probably, if you were listing number one on the concern of probably, you know, an overwhelming majority of the people in Philadelphia, that would be the number one. And it's both within the clauses, the final clauses, the draft clauses, and putting in the context of the document itself, that is like number one. I mean, treason is one of the things that is listed, although they are careful in the Constitution of listing a very specific definition of treason.
Right. You know. I mean, I think there are some other scenarios that Madison raises in the debates. So, for example, he says, you know, what if the president loses his capacity, right, after his appointment? That's something that we took care of by amendment later on, right? So there are some other sort of situations.
Madison also mentions schemes of peculation and oppression, which I think do come up a little more importantly within the discussion of impeachment. And again, that can tie into bribery. We could tie that to a discussion of the emoluments clause as well, that there is a broader fear expressed that the executive is a sufficiently powerful position that it could be used to accumulate personal wealth through the misuse of office. But at the same time, it's mentioned in debates, and then it's kind of left hanging. And this is one of the difficulties that we like to have an answer, don't we? When we're asked, what did the founders think? They weren't sure.
Yeah, Ken, I think the point's really clear that, like, even specific founders themselves don't have a clear answer to this, right? This brings us to the issue of, like, maladministration, as they would say at that time.
Right.
Like Madison gives one answer in his notes on the Constitution, but when he was a congressperson, he gave a whole different, completely different answer. And that's even before the political, like, cauldron of the 1790s really kicked off. Early in the Washington administration, he's giving a very different answer about what deserves to be removed, including something that might support, you know, impeachments like the Johnson impeachment, that removing, you know, deserving officers from the federal government is grounds for impeachment, like, which is something he's more skeptical of in his published, records of the federal convention. So, they, you know, even singular founders don't have a clear answer to these questions.
That's a really important point. I mean, one of the terms that they used, that multiple delegates used, Mason, Madison, Morris, used, was corruption. I mean, I think you know, when you use the word corruption, you know, I think people have a sort of some vague idea of what we think that means today. What did that mean in the 18th century? What is corruption when Madison or Morris say corruption? What do they mean by that?
I mean, are we going to turn into a 4-hour episode of Hardcore History discussing this, Michael?
I mean, it's been 4 years. I'm sure we've accumulated a lot to say in that time.
You know, there's the high intellectual history definition of corruption. But I think that the founders were willing to break it into multiple categories. And, you know, earlier drafts, like, again, I want to go back to that term, because when I was going over this stuff in preparation for this, like, the constant use initially of this term, like, maladministration, that, like, I think that even more than just, like, corruption, which I think both in a 21st century casual sense and a, you know, 18th century specific political terminology of using power to serve selfish ends, like, against the state, like, I think, like, there was a lot of agreement that could be a reason for for impeachment, but I mean, what to do about a president who is bad at their job, mm-hmm. and is like, they go back and forth in these debates about whether impeachment is the right tool for that. And, yeah. And that I think is really interesting because, and that shows goes back to the earlier theme that we were talking about earlier about the tension between impeachment and elections, right? Is the election the appropriate veto point for the people to be able to say this president was terrible, bad at their job, pick poor officers for the United States? Or does Congress have a role to save the country from, you know, if you find this out 1-2 years into a president's term, is it part of the Congress's job to remove that person from office to prevent further damage to the state and to the people before the people themselves are able to act in their constitutionally enabled point 4 years later? I think it's an interesting tension. And in the maladministration language is in the draft late into the process, yeah. because I think it's something that they take really seriously. And to be honest with you, is a big structural problem in the Constitution is what to do with people who are bad at governing, short of elections.
I mean, maladministration does not necessarily imply malintent, right? And I think if we look at the sort of the things that are enumerated, treason and bribery, both could be considered forms of corruption. If we think about some of the other examples that we talked about, like foreign assistance or peculation that Ken was talking about. Those are forms of corruption, right? And I think probably most fundamentally it comes down to an abuse, right? An abuse of the public trust, right? That anyone who's holding office abuses the public trust in that way, with malintent, right? Then that can be considered corruption.
Yes, I mean it won't surprise you that I turn to the 1776 Pennsylvania Constitution on this, but that the language of government is for the whole community and not for any men or set of men who are a part only of that community. That stands in pretty well as a definition or a working definition of corruption. It's placing avowedly partial interests above the interests of the community or the nation as a whole. Of course, as we see in the Federalist Papers, what qualifies as national interest or partial interest is very different. I mean, Gordon Wood has written volumes on this stuff. This isn't something that's unfamiliar to those of us that are reading widely in the political history of the early Republic. When we think of it in corruption in those general terms, it does underline one of these things that's been underlying everything we've been saying, which is how difficult it is to put this in a legal text of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. Maladministration turns everything into a question of competence rather than intent. But if you mm-hmm. start to put something in that's much more geared towards corruption, then it becomes much more legalistic and it becomes much more narrow. Right. And then you have to start envisaging every single way in which a president or a judicial officer can screw the country over. And when you start doing that, you kind of probably want to go back to a state of nature.
Yeah, the house of cards starts to fall. I mean, when Morris brings up the issue of corruption, when they ask him what should be impeachable, he says corruption and some other offenses, but whatever those are, they have to be enumerated and defined, right? And so that's the exact process that Ken is talking about, the convention trying to avoid. You know, it's another example of the important role of ambiguity, right, in the Constitution itself, and it sort of reminds me of Jonathan Gnapp's recent book, The Second Creation, right, which is really about, you know, how in the years after the Constitutional Convention in the years of the early Republic, effectively, much of that ambiguity had to be defined in practice, right, over a period of time, rather than, you know, being defined in some kind of holistic way at the convention.
Absolutely. So this seems like a good time to move on to when Congress did actually impeach in the first 20 years of the existence of the new government. And there's three examples that feature particularly heavily in this history. The impeachment of Senator William Blunt of Tennessee in the 1790s, and then in the early 1800s in Jefferson's first term, the impeachments of District Judge John Pickering of New Hampshire, and later the impeachment of Samuel Chase of Maryland, who at that time was Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. I think we should probably go through and outline a little bit about the circumstances of each of those impeachments. So, Michael, did you have anything you wanted to outline about Blunt's impeachment?
So Blunt is the first impeachment. This occurs in 1798, and he was a signer of the Constitution from North Carolina. He had served in Congress in the 1780s. But by the 1790s, he had moved to Tennessee and become a senator from Tennessee. He'd be a product of his penchant for land speculation. It was uncovered around 1797 that he had been trying to conspire with Britain and with Native Americans to seize Louisiana from Spain before Spain eventually lost it to France, because he was worried that France would cut off access to the Mississippi River, and that would hurt the value of these Western lands that so many speculators were holding. There's very much sort of shades of the Burr conspiracy, right, with Blunt. But so this scheme was uncovered in 1797, and he was impeached by the House in 1798, and then early the following year, the Senate actually dismissed the charges because he had fled. He had fled back to Tennessee after he posted bail, but also because the Senate had already sequestered his seat. And they tried to set a precedent here, and this is goes back to, you know, working this out in practice. They tried to set a precedent here that senators could not be impeached by the House, and that so that they could only be removed by two-thirds of the vote of the Senate. So that's really, I think, the long-term significance of the Blunt impeachment.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely an important moment in the congressional history, right, where it sort of begins the crystallization of a very important political principle today, which is that the House and the Senate have absolute control over their own membership, and they're the ones who decide who can sit in the Senate, who can sit in the House. Even to the point of overriding voters. I mean, that's like we don't talk about that a lot. I mean, the negative side of it doesn't frequently happen. It's frequently used as sort of a soft impeachment to remove truly rapscallion members of our national legislature. But if you look at the history in the Civil War and the post-Civil War period, it's much more, it was frequently used to exclude, Southern unreformed Confederates who have been elected to office and things like that. So it's a very important moment in that later history.
And I think it also underscores the importance of public shame in discussions of impeachment as well, that even if it created some fairly severe limits on powers of impeachment from the House's point of view, at the same time, its functional purpose in getting Blunt out of the Senate and out of Washington and being less of a troublemaker around the seat of government, it did work. The process cast enough light on the nefarious schemes of Blunt that it was able to tampen down what claims to public authority he might otherwise have been able to maintain.
I think it's also important for the ways it crystallized what a civil officer is in the United States, that members of the legislative branch aren't civil officers, I think is, interesting in reinforcing that separation of powers that, and it's just sort of, this is like a weirdly undersold piece of American legislative history.
And in that distinction with civil officers, it's notable that the other two examples of impeachment that we're going to talk about now relate to judicial officers, very much appointed civil officers under the United States Constitution. And both of these impeachments come out of lingering anger at the resolution of the election of 1800. So this is well known, and we've talked about it on the podcast before, about the difficulty of resolving the election between Jefferson and Adams. But one of the things that Adams does in the waning days of his administration is makes a number of changes to the functioning of the judiciary, essentially making the judiciary a much more secure federalist branch of government at a time that the legislature and the executive have slipped out of federalist hands. And those changes, Madison tries to hold back some of the appointments, which leads to the famous ruling in Marbury versus Madison, that the appointments of a previous president must stand. And so I mention all of this to outline the fact that there has been wrangling for several years about the improper nature of Adams' appointment to the judiciary and the appointment of his midnight judges, and that Republicans are looking for some way of redressing the balance so that the appointment to the judicial branch more accurately reflect the electoral power of the Republicans in the early 1800s. The first case that they fix on is the case of John Pickering in New Hampshire. And in some ways, it's a curious case in that by the time that Pickering is impeached, he is not of sound mind and is frequently inebriated on the bench, to put it mildly, and I will come back to the case that forms the particular articles of impeachment. This is not to completely impeach, for want of a better term, Pickering's character. I mean, he has been a loyal American through the Revolution, and it was only recently that he lost his mind and his sobriety. However, given the circumstances of the early 1800s, it was clear that Pickering would be replaced by a Republican were he to step down from the bench. Mm-hmm. And Pickering was widely connected to and respected by New Hampshire's Federalist Party. And therefore, what might previously have been dealt with a quiet resignation, instead became a partisan political showdown in which Pickering was impeached for improper conduct in holding a trial. The story of the trial is quite remarkable. He appears on multiple days drunk on the bench. He incites violence amongst those who are attending. He prejudges the case. He announces what he's going to rule. When the lawyers then insist on hearing the case, he says, "You can argue this case for 4,000 years. I don't care. I'm still going to find this way at the end of it." They start to lay out their case, and then he decides after a few minutes that actually he's heard enough and that he doesn't need to sit there for 4,000 years. He can make the judgment anyway. When the losing counsel announces intention to appeal, he says, "You can appeal for all I care. I'll still be sat on the bench when the case is heard." And so it becomes a very intemperate, heated argument. Part of the reason for this is that it's not easy to point to a high crime or misdemeanor. It is very simple to point towards unfitness for office. Mm-hmm. But to say that Pickering has being guilty of high crimes and misdemeanors suggests and implies that he is of sound mind, that he couldn't use insanity as a defense, and that therefore you have this really curious bringing of impeachment in which the House goes out of its way not to mention the insanity of Pickering when the trial is heard. But at the same time, the Federalists are basically saying, no, we cannot get rid of this Federalist judge off the bench, even though that puts them in the position of defending conduct that is quite clearly detrimental to the good standing of Federalist judiciary. And so at the end of the day, that means that impeachment is used to remove Pickering from the bench, and it often goes down in the literature as a partisan ruling, although in some ways it might be better understood as showing the difficulties of actually how do you remove someone who's unfit from office. At this point, I do want to bring in the state constitutions. A lot of the state constitutions allow for the removal of an unfit judge by address of the legislature, which means that they can, if there's a sufficient vote in the legislature, they can then petition the governor to remove, and that becomes automatic without finding the judge criminal. They're just found to, they're found to be incompetent for office. But that's not in the federal constitution. And instead it becomes this test case of what the limits of the impeachment power are.
And it's a really smart chess case for the Jeffersonians to pick, right? Like, if you're trying to create political space for impeachment that doesn't, like, directly align with high crimes and misdemeanors, then someone like Pickering, who has the, you know, negative thing for the Jeffersonians of being, like, a diehard Federalist loyalist who's making Federalist rulings, but also is a wicked drunk who is just incompetent, and even Federalists agree is incompetent. So this is a great place to begin setting that precedent. And it's going to lead into the next impeachment, of course, that we're talking about, which is Samuel Chase, which is an attempt to bring that precedent of removing judges from office for lack of fitness of character to someone who is cantankerous, but not necessarily as wantonly incompetent as Pickering. He's just as much a partisan Federalist as Pickering, but not a drunk, or at least not a visible, a non-functioning alcoholic, and, you know, is capable of mounting a defense against that. But I think it's a really wise political decision of the Jeffersonians to start there, and shows that there's this careful building towards beginning to purge the federal judiciary of federalism.
So why was Chase impeached?
So there were 8 articles of impeachment. It was related to his conduct as a judge in the circuit courts, including multiple cases relating to the Alien Sedition Acts. Chase was very sharp in enforcing the Alien Sedition Acts. Of course, that's not going to make you popular with Republicans. But, you know, it was Jeffersonian printers in Maryland and other states that he was enforcing this upon. And he, you know, didn't do so with a appearance of impartiality either, and a willingness to, overrule juries, lawyers, and things like that to make the clear case that people deserve to be convicted for these Alien Sedition Acts. So he was using the bench in a strongly partisan way. And so that's sort of what gets him on the radar of, I mean, Thomas Jefferson was calling for his impeachment. So to the point in which you're on the president's agenda to be removed from office. And he was definitely sort of one of the high-flying Federalists, because, of course, Samuel Chase has, you know, a great resume as a founder, right? He's one of the big founders of Maryland, you know, roots back, you know, like Pickering as well. Well, roots back to that throughout the signing the Declaration of Independence, you know, through to the Federalist period, you know, so he has this deep background that sort of makes him in some ways, you know, unassailable, but he is using his power in a partisanly Federalist way, and that puts into the attention of the Jeffersonians. They want to use this precedent that was set with Pickering to remove him, but they fail. And I think that that's the big moment of, you know, impeachment, you know, not where, yes, the Pickering cases of the world, where there's a clear unfitness for office, may hold, and we'll see, you know, subsequently that will happen with judges. But partisan judges are not going to be able to be impeached.
Well, I think you...
That's the precedent there.
I think you cut to the chase really well there, Roy. That was a pun worth waiting 4 years for.
It definitely was. I've been chasing Chase for a long time, so he's all over Maryland records. If you want to study the revolution in Maryland, so.
I mean, I think that it's worth pointing out that of these three, Pickering is the only one who is convicted by the Senate, right? And I mean, if we're thinking in terms of broad takeaways from these. From these three cases, I think, you know, one of them, which we've alluded to, is the fact that all of these impeachments were at least viewed by many at the time as politically motivated, right? So impeachment from its very beginnings in the early Republic, you know, has been seen as a partisan political process, right?
Yeah, and that's where I want to push back against some of what Roy said about Pickering being such a smart choice as a test case for impeachment, because one of the things that the Pickering case showed up was that the Republicans were not completely in line when it came to questions of impeachment. And the defense of Pickering had a number of very talented lawyers lining up in Pickering's defense. And one of the things that they were able to do was to raise enough procedural and legal quibbles about the undertaking of the Senate that it kind of undermined partisanship as a rationale. And that at the end of the day, no one was going to shed too many tears about Pickering being off the bench. They might about the results of Pickering being off the bench, insofar as it was going to lead to a Republican sitting on the court in New Hampshire. But the actual result wasn't going to be that much of a problem. But by allowing all of these debates to get clouded in the specious partisanship that was being drawn up by both sides on the Pickering impeachment, it did mean that by then pivoting straight to Chase, and I mean the House investigation of Chase begins almost as soon as Pickering's trial starts. Because that moves quite so quickly, those who have been on the fence about whether they were pushing a procedural point to carry out a governmental good suddenly find themselves in a position not too far down the line where they're pretty much having to say, well, actually, if we were a little bit uneasy about this with Pickering, we really can't say that the same thing applies to Chase.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I think...
Well taken.
Did you want to respond to that, Roy?
No, well taken. I think that Pickering... I mean, there's a reason, though, that they started with Pickering and not Chase, right? Because, I mean, both were targeted by, you know, by Jefferson. I mean, this is what's so interesting about this particular episode, right, is that it's Republicans throughout the branches of the federal government that are working together to do this, which is... how am I put this? It feels a little unusual to us sitting here today in the 21st century that you would have the President of the United States, Thomas Jefferson, saying to his congressional allies, we got to get these people off the bench for Republican, you know, for the good of the Republican cause. And, you know, I think Pickering's the right place to start to set that precedent. Now, of course, obviously how it plays out isn't perfect for the Republicans and does contribute to Chase's acquittal. But I think that of all the Federalist judges, Pickering was the lowest hanging fruit and the best place to start.
So I think that certainly the Pickering and the Chase cases, you know, show that an important part of this early practice of impeachment had to do with the changing nature of the judiciary and the process of defining the judiciary. Roy refers to Marbury Madison, and Ken talked about this a little bit, but the process of defining the judiciary played an important role here. These impeachments played an important role in that process, right?
I think also what's really important here is to go back to our earlier discussion about the role, but the tension between elections and impeachment, right? That there is no election to remove judges from office who end up being unfit. Mm-hmm. Impeachment is the only explicit way in the Constitution to remove a judge from office who's been confirmed by the Senate, short of death. And I think that that's where you get this wiggly precedent that's set by the Pickering case, which is, he probably committed no high crime and misdemeanor under what, most legal scholars today, and probably, to be honest with you, most legal scholars in the 19th century would say, but was so clearly unfit for office that we're willing to fudge the what impeachment says in the Constitution to serve as a check on the life-serving institution that is the federal judiciary. And if we look at the broader history throughout the 19th, 20th, and 21st century, judges are the overwhelming majority of cases that lead to either the person resigning from office before they can be convicted or convicted and removed from office. And I think that's the role that impeachment has fallen into in the American political system. It's proven to be impossible so far in American history to successfully remove a president from office, but it hasn't, it's not common, but it's, concurrent enough that it is a tool within, as a check against judicial branch by the legislative branch. That is something. I mean, in our lifetime, there have been successful impeachments of judges in the United States. And, they don't make the news, and, it's not something that's overly studied, but it is something that is present. And it starts here with Pickering.
So we're running a little short on time at this stage. And one of the difficulties of talking about impeachment is that there really aren't all that many examples of the impeachment power actually being used. But to conclude, we probably want to stretch beyond our usual purview of early America to look into the Civil War and Reconstruction and the most famous 19th century impeachment, that of President Andrew Johnson. And Roy, I know you had thoughts on this.
Right. I mean, this is we talked a little bit earlier about one of the tensions in Philadelphia with the founding of the Constitution, the writing of the Constitution, being the tension between could impeachment be a tool for legislative overreach, where the legislative branch is trying to overregulate and step on the prerogatives of the executive branch. And traditionally, that has how the impeachment of Andrew Johnson has been interpreted, that, it's a profile in courage that, going back to the Kennedy narrative, but historians before him that he's building on have argued that, Johnson's impeachment by the radical Republicans was an overreach by Congress, that they were overregulating the president's prerogative to appoint officers to serve in the executive branch, and that it was good for the executive branch and for the country that Johnson was defeated. But that, of course, is starting to be reconsidered by presidential historians and by congressional historians in light of just how poor Johnson's historical reputation has gotten. And particularly in the context of the 21st century, we can see that the causes that Johnson was committed to are just so awful. And, Johnson's action and the action that Johnson's taking against fellow citizens, particularly citizens of color, being so abhorrent that the actions of Congress to impeach him become and to highly regulate his actions as president and then to impeach him are starting to be rehabilitated. And I think that's sort of an interesting – it's, I think, one of the most interesting re-examinations of the impeachment process that's been done because, basically since shortly after the Johnson – impeachment in the 19th century was viewed as a great near miss, that we almost screwed up our political system. But we're now sitting here in the 21st century saying that no, this was actually a missed opportunity to rein in the presidency, and is sort of in many ways reversing the logic that the founders had with how they set up the impeachment process or some of the concerns they had about the impeachment process.
And I think that also says something about the ways in which the Civil War and modern society changed the presidency, that the way that the president operated in the 19th century and in the late 1860s was understood differently to how it was now, even though historians would now look at the 1860s as quite an important transitional point in terms of the evolving powers of the presidency, that makes a big difference in how we perceive the role that the president plays. I mean, the other thing that I take out of what you've mentioned there about the re-examination of Johnson is that impeachment is kind of the break glass in case of emergency procedure. that almost by nature, if you are threatening to bring impeachment against a president, you are at, by definition, a moment of constitutional crisis. And the problem with moments of constitutional crisis is that you don't have a ready-made playbook for how to handle those moments of constitutional crisis. And therefore, it becomes comforting to say, oh, well, everything worked. Yeah, there was a procedure in place. There was a procedure in place for a reason. The procedure worked. I mean, all that means is that the procedure was followed. But it's very easy for that to come
in. Results-oriented thinking.
Yes. It becomes much more embedded into the system that we can trust the system. But it doesn't lead to particularly deep thinking about any of the issues that might make impeachment necessary in the first place, particularly because it is neither a political nor a legal process. It's a little bit from column A and a little bit from column B.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that all three presidential trials really just show, and this is the theme that goes back to one of our oldest episodes about the Constitution, that you know, lots of things about the Constitution operate properly because of the liminal nature of it, the fact that it's so vague. Both the times that we've had these three trials, you know, Trump, Clinton, and Johnson, just shows just though the darker side of that liminal nature and that open-ended nature of the Constitution and many of the most important clauses.
Ambiguity is a double-edged sword.
Well, I think that is as good an end as any to our discussion of impeachment in early America, and I'm glad that we managed to get to the end of the hour without me having to get the House to draw up any articles or to seek anyone's removal. But all that leaves me to do is to thank Michael Hatton for joining me.
Thank you, Ken.
And to thank Roy Rogers for joining me.
Thanks, Ken.
And to thank you for joining us. It's been great to have you back as an audience. We look forward to being here for you again sometime in the near future. Thank you for joining us on the JuntoCast. We hope to see you again for the next episode.
That was not very good on your... I think it's funny that the introduction comes off like we've been away for 3 months.
It's
been 4 years.